You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Test. This is rock and roll. Time to rock it from the Delta to the DMZ. Is that me or does that sound like an Elvis Presley movie? Viva Da Nang. Oh, Viva Da Nang. Da Nang me, why don't they get a rope and hang me? Hey, is it a little too early for being that loud? Hey, too late. It's 0600. What's the O stand for? Oh, my God, it's early.
Yeah, it is early. Joining me.
Oh, I tell you though, I giggle every time I hear that.
Adrian Kronauer.
Yeah. By the way.
Yeah.
Bonjour, mon ami.
Bonjour. I don't know what that means, but okay, man.
Good morning, my friends. How are you today?
I'm all right. I'm all right. I thought it was kind of interesting reading the lyrics of the German and the French and the British. The French national anthem is like everybody's getting slaughtered. It's an angry.
Well, that's why there's a Bastille Day, because the
they were pissed. The
average every other Frenchman was pissed at the aristocracy. And so they chopped all their heads off.
Well, you know, the song's a pissed-off song. It's like, you know, when you read the Declaration of Independence, you know, it's a pissed-off document, you know, and it comes through. But, you know, the French language and the melody of Le Marseillais is beautiful, right?
Oh, it's gorgeous.
And then you read the lyrics. It's like, what the hell is that? What they've been singing about all these years? Who knew?
Yeah.
Who knew? Yeah. So when you see them on a soccer thing singing, you know, their national anthem, it's like,
yeah,
they're like killing the bastards and chopping their heads off and soaking the fields with blood. You're like, what? Oh my God! Funny.
That's a horror movie.
It is. Yeah. Well, you know, when the French, when they had the revolution, that was like not a good thing, man. There, a lot of bad. I mean, a lot of people drug out and done away with. It was a brutal part in the history of their nation. But it set them on the path to being a democratic government. And their transition from a monarch, and so interesting stuff. But I had no idea. I had no idea that the song was that violent. But anyway, you know.
And I got to tell you, I didn't either. And I lived 5 years in Europe.
What is it, a little bit of food history? What is it about the French? And what is their most significant contribution in terms of food? Because I will tell you this, I can't think of too many French things that I eat on a regular basis, other than French fries and French toast, which I don't think are French at all. So, or maybe they are.
French fries are. What? French toast is not. French toast is 100% Yankee.
You. Why, so what is the major French contribution to the culinary arts?
Well, it started with Fernand Pont, one of the great chefs of France, and he brought in haute cuisine, which, you know, the French, when they would cook things, sometimes the meat wasn't all that delicious, but they invented all these sauces to cover everything up. and sauces are probably their great invention. And then came Paul Bocuse, who introduced Nouvelle Cuisine, which is lighter sauces, fresher ingredients. It's when the movement became everybody around the world started the freshest ingredients available. And yes, you can have sauces, but it's you treat it with delicacy.
Okay, so
and
so
it highlights the flavor of whatever you're eating. The sauces today do.
Okay, so the first thing they do is called hot.
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 H A U. Jesus. H A G H A U
T E
T. Hot is pronounced Hot Cuisine.
Hot Cuisine. Okay, so that's the first, yeah. And then. And that is obviously a very upscale kind of a thing. And then after
yes.
that, after that comes
Nouvelle or Nouveau Cuisine. Nouvelle, and Paul Bocuse is the godfather, and he has a restaurant on the Rhone River in Lyon, which in 1973, 1974, and 1975, after our hotel closed down in Switzerland, 2 weeks after Easter, we would make a beeline to Paul Bocuse's restaurant in Lyon. Oh my God, it was the best food I've ever had at the time, and hard to really match it. But one of the things I had was a small chicken cooked inside a pig's bladder. Now, it sounds gross, but they put this bladder and tie it off, and then somebody stands over it for a couple of hours, hour and a half, in a bouillon. And they baste the bladder, and when it comes to the table, it's like a this balloon with a chicken inside. And they break it open, and the aroma from all the juices and the tender chicken just envelop the table. And then this is all done tableside, and then they take the bladder away. They take the chicken out, carve it up, take the skin off, and then cover it with a delicate sauce made from truffles and cream. It's just magnificent. I've had some great food there. And the last time I was there, there were seven of us. We were on our way to Italy, and we stopped there. We stayed in Lyon for a couple of days, and we took the bus out. We had reservations. We always had to have reservations. We piled out of the van, and I look up, and who's from the parking lot, and I look up, and who's standing by our table. I didn't know it was going to be our table. It was Paul Bocuse himself. And he's a gentleman at the time. He was about 50. He's still alive. And he's about 6'3", and he had at least a 12, 14-inch toque. Now, that's the chef hat. That's what they call the chef hat. And he's got his arms crossed, and he's in his dress whites, chef whites, and he's looking at us, pile out of this. There's four guys and three women, and, straighten ourselves up, and we walk up. And you walk up this stairway, and the restaurant's in a house. And you walk by the kitchen, and you look in, and there's got a dozen to two dozen chefs and apprentices scurrying around, scrubbing. And you look and say, just throw my food on the floor. I'll eat off the floor. and all the copper is shiny, and there you couldn't take a microscope and find any dust in that kitchen or any dirt. That's how clean it is. And it,
okay,
and
hold
walk
on.
By
we're kind of getting off the subject here. I wanted to talk about French food, and we're talking about Paul Bocuse. We're talking about Paul Bocuse's Clean Kitchen.
Yeah.
Are you with me?
Okay. Anyway, French food is. What do you want to know? I hope.
This is why I'm here. Okay. Kim gets Kim gets fired up, and pretty soon we're going that way around the planet, and we need to go that way. All right. I want to know is.
And I love you for it because you can tell I'm excited about French food.
Well, I mean, what is. It's not. What parts of French, of the French culinary art have made its way into American food, American cuisine, which is mutt cuisine, right? We love Italian. We love Mexican. We don't like English food. We don't like Polish food or Irish food.
We love Polish food.
We do?
The sausages.
Okay.
Are you kidding me?
All right. So how is French cuisine, how has it impacted American cuisine?
Well, from the bread, the baguette. The baguette to the way they prepare. They use every part of a pig, from the snoot to the hoof to the tail. In Europe and France too, especially, well, every country in Europe, they use every part of the animal. They use the bladders. But anyway, the French have this way of preparing foods with sauces and not overcooking food, not undercooking it like meat, but they cook it so it's juicy, and all the way to the cheeses. When you finish a French meal, they will at Bocuse's and most other places. They wheel this cart with French cheeses. And it's before the dessert carts. And you just pick whatever cheeses you want. I like a creamy, a soft cheese, a gooey cheese, and some of them are stinky.
Okay, let me stop you right there. All right, I'm going to ask you for the third time. How does French cuisine impact American cuisine? What is the major... When we think of the things of American cuisine, the hamburger, the hot dog, pizza, the way we eat, does French cuisine, is it in there? Have we absorbed it? Have we been impervious to it? Been impervious to it?
The breads, way they prepare sauces. I would say sauces are the biggest addition to American culinary process is saucing any meats, steaks, chops, chicken, veal, and the way that they don't overcook their foods.
Okay, so when I look at my mom's, the way she makes pork chops, okay, so Kathleen's, the way Kathleen would make pork chops is that she would lightly brown the pork chops in a frying pan, and then she would dump cream of mushroom soup and condensed milk, and then she would simmer that stuff for a few hours, and boom. Muy delicioso.
Yes, it is, but it's... The French would take those pork chops, yes, and they would brown them in a pan, whether they dust them or not, and their sauces would be made from heavy cream, homemade chicken stock or pork stock from the bones, the leftover bones from breaking down a hog, and they cook the stock for a couple of days, and the sauces are mushrooms. They're fresh picked mushrooms, and they could be chanterelles, morels. The variety of mushrooms that are grown in France, which we grow here now, but back then they were way ahead in foraging and getting fresh ingredients. And I think that's their biggest contribution, is the freshness of their sauces. They don't open cans. That's what my mother did.
Yeah, don't be careful. Yeah, be careful now.
No, I'm just telling you.
All right.
My mother opened cans of mushrooms. She didn't help make a cream sauce from scratch. She was clueless. And I'm speaking for my mother.
All right.
When I went to France, and the first time I had liver that I could eat, it was in a brown sauce, and the liver was medium rare. And when I got done my second plate, and it was served over creamy polenta, which is a cornmeal like grits in this country. And I said to my host, this is the best beef stew I've ever had. And they started laughing at me. Oh, hell no, man. You just ate liver, medium rare liver. And I went, say what?
What?
My mother cooked liver and onions where I could wear it on my shoe and go to school. And I couldn't, you know, you could chew for 3 days and it still couldn't swallow it. So, but my dad loved it, and that's what she did, and that's what she knew. Well, the French, any French cook in any French household knows how to cook from scratch. And that's how it got started, you know. When I was watching go out in the yard, and we do it here, grab a chicken, twist its head, and take the head off, and we let it run around the yard till all the blood runs out, then go pluck it and eat it that night. Now, the first time you see that, a farm kid in this country would just say, so what? Well, a hayseed like me saw that. I was fascinated. It didn't gross me out. It just said, holy shit. This is how it's done? Yeah, it's stupid. But the freshness of everything is what their contribution is, and taking ingredients and making something, and when you make a sauce, you blend herbs and you blend ingredients to make a whole different taste, and to talk about it seems complicated. But to a French chef or housewife, it's not complicated. That's how they grew up.
Okay. All right. I got it. Let me read you an email. Hey, Mac, I'm curious. When I go out for dinner and there may be a French restaurant, an Italian restaurant, and maybe a steak place, I rarely choose a French restaurant. Why do you think that is? And I don't think I'm alone as an American. I don't know that French cuisine has exactly endeared itself to the American palate. I think that's kind of like me. You know, I would, Italian or French? Pfft, come on, not even close, man. Not even going near that French stuff. Your thoughts on that, Kim?
I worked in Italy I worked in Italy for a long time, but there were all French restaurants all over everywhere. But when the difference between French cooking and Italian cooking, now Italians are going to hate me for this, but it's a little bit, more sophisticated.
What, French?
A little bit more
French
complicated flavors.
French cooking. French cooking, yeah.
Yes. It's the flavors are different. They're more delicate. And when you look into a French kitchen, you'll see probably twice as many chefs as you would in my kitchen or an Italian kitchen, because they all have responsibilities.
Okay, no. But I want to talk about why do you think that is? I think that that's fairly typical. Most Americans would not gravitate to a French restaurant. They would.
Well, foie gras, for example. Now, foie gras, that's goose liver.
Right.
And the French take a goose and they force feed it. I mean, force feed it, hold their head back and pour grains and things down their throats, and their livers get to be four or five times their size, and they kill it. And then this liver looks like big softballs, and cross between a softball and a volleyball. And it's a very rich, decadent liver. And if you cook it too long, it melts. And that's one of the things the French are known for, is foie gras. And that's a pâté, not like I made, because I use chicken livers. And this is something that stands alone. And I've served foie gras at Sanders, and I took Calvados, which is a French apple brandy, and I sauteed apples in butter and flamed it with the Calvados.
Okay, but hold on. You're not answering the question again. Why do you think Americans...
It's intimidating. It's intimidating.
Does it taste good as Italian food? Because... I think most people would walk into an Italian joint, 8 to 2, 7 to 3, 9 to 1. They would walk into an Italian place before they walk into a French food place, which is odd because French have, such a great history.
How it started was you walk into a French restaurant and everybody's snobbish in there. And they hand you a menu that's in freaking French and maybe having English subtitles. And you're supposed to know what the hell everything means. And in this country, if you walk into a place and you ask them questions and you feel they're arrogant or trying to talk down to you, you tell them to fuck off and get up and walk out. They're getting wiser now on how they approach Yanks. And, when I lived in Europe in the 70s, the French treated us like dirt. And if you didn't speak their dialect of French, you were a peasant. And that was just, and I don't know why, we sold your asses in World War I and World War II. And you're just trying to get a decent meal and ask some questions. And you know how we are. We're friendly people.
Right.
And so that has changed. Now, the last time I was in Paris, everybody spoke English. And you got to thank CNN, MTV, old movies. And they... The first movie I saw in Europe was in Italy, and it was All Quiet on the Western Front, done in Italian.
Whoa.
If I hadn't seen it two or three times, I wouldn't have a clue what's going on. But I mean, that's just.
Do you think it's the cultural thing? Is Americans are turned off to that kind of arrogance and. And so therefore we just haven't been as open to. I think it's interesting because they have you know, when you look at food, it's like, you know, oh, French cuisine, blah, 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 blah. But I don't know anybody who, you know, who says, hey, come on over, we'll eat French. You know, it's just not
it's
done.
It's killer good food. It's out of this world food. But, you know, when I was now you walk into a French restaurant, the menu might have English first and then the French underneath it. They've reversed that arrogance. They're friendly. Everybody speaks to you with grace and respect. When I was over there, you try and speak French, and I was always taught, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. So, yes, I had my little French book, guidebook with phrases and stuff, and they'd laugh at you and answer, like, you know, you could tell they were saying something in French that was insulting to you. And so, you know, I'd still smile and I'd point to what I wanted.
Right.
I mean, they make killer pâtés and terrains, salamis. They make great food, sausages. But back then in 1970s, if you didn't speak French, you weren't worth the time. Now, when I tried to speak Italian, the reason I learned Italian in 3 months was they'd kind of chuckle and they would repeat. They knew what you were trying to say. They'd say it to you in Italian and they'd make you repeat it back to them. And they loved their language. They loved who they were, Italians. I'm talking in the 70s.
Right.
When I lived there. And so they made the effort to help you learn their language because you were making the effort to say something in Italian to them. And they might have spoke perfect English. But to get anybody in France in 1970 to speak English to you, forget about it.
Forget about it. Interesting. Interesting that their cultural arrogance. Because let me tell you, when you talk to people that travel throughout Europe, they will still tell you that the two countries that you go to be prepared for arrogance are France and Israel. You will get it in spades in both those countries. They don't have time.
Yeah.
They don't have time for you. And again, that's just people that travel. And you get into a discussion about traveling around Europe and, you know, what places are welcoming and what places are not. You know, for instance, the Irish have and I'm not saying this because I'm descendant of Irish because I'm American, but the Irish have a great reputation. The Irish have a great reputation for being welcoming and hospitable and open, and where the French have exactly the arrogance as a culture, you know, that you mention. And so it's interesting that would impact, you know, possibly the way their food is received as well. Another email question.
I'm sure that Mac,
hold on. If French toast didn't come from France, where did it come from? Why is it called French? Kim, do you know the history of French?
Do you know the history
of French toast?
Maybe that's how they cooked their stale bread. They dipped it in an egg wash and then grilled it. But the first time I had French toast was in this country, and now they raised the. You remember my creme caramel?
Yes, I do.
Okay, that custard that I used to make that creme caramel. Now, what they do with French toast now?
Oh.
In the places they soak it in a thick cut bread. It's not Wonder Bread. It's got to be and it can be day old, and you slice it about an inch thick, and you take it in that, and it's cold the custard. And you soak it in that, and then you put that on the grill, and it'll puff up a little bit, and then you're in the front row.
All right, let me read you the history of it. One of the earliest versions of French toast has been traced back to the Roman Empire. The name French toast was first used in the 17th century in England. The recipe and name were brought to America by early settlers. In France, the dish is called pain perdu, P-A-I-N-P-E-R-D-U, meaning lost bread. So, as you said, it was a dish made to utilize stale bread.
Yep.
Wow. You know what? I find the history of food interesting because you know you and I have talked about menudo and all pig's feet, chicken feet, all these different things that have become delicacies or gourmet foods started out as dishes that immigrants used because they had to use the whole pig that they bought or slaughtered. You know, they had the whole chicken because, you know, they just didn't have the money to go out and buy additional things. So they found ways to prepare these things. I find that fascinating. And then so French toast is you moisten the bread and then you fry it as a way to use stale bread. Wow.
That's right.
How crazy is that? The French toast was not invented in France. So let me read you one more. Myth. French toast was invented in France. French toast was not invented in France. In fact, French toast was around long before France even existed as a country. The exact origin of French toast are unknown, but it isn't surprising that humans seem to have come up with the recipe quickly, given that French toast is traditionally made of stale bread. Bread has been a staple food for most cultures since first food began being prepared, and up until recently, the vast majority of humans would have never dreamed of wasting any food. Thus, one has to find a way to take stale bread palatable. Soaking it in milk and egg and then cooking it seems logical enough, making a good tasty meal while not wasting any bread. The earliest reference to doing just this dates all the way back to 4th century Rome in a cookbook attributed to Apicus, and it is thought to predate this work by a good margin. The style of French toast was called pan dulcis. The Romans would take the bread, soak it in milk and an egg mixture, and then cook it, typically frying it in oil or butter, pretty much just as it's made today in many countries around the world. This practice became common throughout Europe in the Middle Ages, including making it primarily out of stale bread. Indeed, the name for French toast in France is pain perdu, which literally means lost bread. It is also called this in Belgium, New Orleans, Newfoundland, and the Congo, among other places. It's interesting to note, for the naysayers who like to cling to the belief that it came from France, that before the French called it pain perdu, they called it pain à la romaine, meaning Roman bread.
Roman bread, yeah.
How about that? I like when we do a little bit of history here. Huh?
Education's a beautiful thing, Mac.
It is. And then somebody slapped the name French toast on it, and boom. And there you go. There you have it. But, you know, like I said, I always do find it fascinating. You know, one of the first dishes we had this discussion about was chicken feet. And I made the comment, like, who in God's name would eat a chicken foot? And you
started it.
Kim went off on me, like, Mac, you know, you don't understand. And I certainly didn't. It's a dish in the German culture as well.
Yes, every culture except and ours is, you know, it's catching on, but way behind the curve. And the fatter the foot, the better it tastes because there's meat in that little paw in the bottom of the foot, that little fatty part, the cartilages, and it's just delish.
Interesting. Interesting. All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more food. We've been talking culinary history here. On Bastille Day. So obviously the French incredible history as a nation. So on this Bastille Day, we looked at the lyrics behind their bloody song. If you
bloody.
Yeah, it's incredible, but it's such a beautiful, it has such a beautiful melody, and the way they sing it in French, it's like, I'm not exactly sure what they're singing. Oh, na, na, la, la, la. Who knew they were singing, who knew they were singing, chop their heads off and spill their blood, right? It sounds so wonderful. Sounds so wonderful. All right, we're going to take a break. This hour of All Marine Radio, brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the one and only Battle Mug. More of Cooking with Pete Kimble coming up next. This hour of All Marine Radio is brought to you by our friends at Battle Mug, home of the world-famous Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at BattleMug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. BattleMug.com.
My name is Juan Perez Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly the special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure out of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our a way of living, a quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there. With folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner, proven and dependable.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
H16 on the left coast. We continue. Pete Kimball home.
Bonjour.
Exactly. We're talking food history. We're talking about why Americans, you know, why we don't embrace French cuisine more. I mean, it's renowned, you know, but Americans, you know, I see a French restaurant, it's like, I don't care. I'm not going in there. I've never, yeah, I don't know why. It's not like I hate French food. I like French fries. I eat them all the time. And we just found out that the Romans invented, or at least had the first recipe in a cookbook in 400 A.D. That made French toast. So doing a little bit of food history. Do you know anything about why the Poles are renowned for Polish sausages?
No, I do not.
Well, because you gave me a little bit of a history lesson why the Italians, why they, you know, the way they did their meats was a way to preserve the meat relative to their climate. And so they preserve their meat by drying it and then wrapping it in salt and hanging it, which is because there was no refrigeration at the time, a way to keep it from spoiling and last through the, you know, the summer, the winter, and different ways. So talk to me about nothing. No history of Polish sausage.
Well, the same reason, but you can stuff it and hang it and smoke it or cook it and then you don't refrigerate it, but when you smoke and cure meats, they can hang forever, you know, and like with any hams, and they do hams in France, everywhere, and they rub them in salt brine and coat them with salt in Italy, Poland. I'm sure that they're similar methods to all those countries of smoking because they didn't have refrigeration, so they had to preserve it. And like the Scandinavians with their salt cod, Italians with baklava, which is, you know, they pack them with salt and then they can last. It's like a board, but it takes a day of rinsing and draining the water to bring them back to life. So pretty much that's universal in Europe, and that's how they preserve their food.
Interesting. But the Poles in particular, the sausage would have been meat or pork that they ground up and then combined with other ingredients. And then preserved it.
Yeah, a filler in oatmeal, you know, fat pieces when they grind up their hogs. You know, they include fat because that gives it a little moisture.
Throw it in there.
But you also smoke it. And by smoking it, that cooks all the bacteria out. And they hang it in cool places, you know, in a cellar or a cave or something like that when they're done to preserve it. And you walk into a butcher shop in any European country, and you'll see all kinds of meats and sausages hanging in the store. And the store could be 75 degrees. And, you know, in the southern quarter, there might be flies running or flying around them and stuff. and in this country, were so anal. When I started my restaurant and I had lived in Italy, I wanted a prosciutto, and I wanted an Italian prosciutto. But I couldn't get Italian prosciutto in this country. I had a source to get a whole prosciutto, you know, a ham
right.
shoulder. And, but no, it wasn't cooked. The only prosciutto I could get was Hormel's imitation of prosciutto.
What?
And yes, I'm just telling you. The health department, it's been impossible. And I had to go to Canada and smuggle my prosciutto in the back of my car.
There you go.
You know?
We love that.
I did. I went to Winnipeg. There was this Italian market. It's still there. It's been there for as long as Winnipeg's been around. DeLuca's. And get my prosciuttos. I couldn't get mortadella. Mortadella is this Italian bologna that's larded with fat and pistachios and peppercorns. And it's to die for. But, you know, that's this country's health regulation.
Oh my God. When I was a sophomore in high school, I went out with I met an Italian girl, and her father was from Italy. Mother was
you lucky guy.
Mother was from Spain, not really. And they would throw these terms around, and I would kind of goof on it. Not in front of them, but always behind their back, like a good, respectful kid would. All these things, prosciutto, smolenka, blakuka, you know, I'm like, what is this?
Saprastata.
I would
salumi. They call it salami. Salumis.
Oh, my God. I would make it up.
Where's that coming from, you know?
But, you know, the Polish sausage. Sausage is a staple of Polish cuisine. And it comes in a dozen varieties, smoked or fresh, made from pork, beef, turkey, lamb, chicken, or veal. With every region of the nation, this is Poland, each region or city will have its own variety. And it talks about, what is it? Kielbasa is the Polish word for sausage. Krakowska kielbasa is a thick, made in Krakow. Is a thick, straight sausage, hot smoke with pepper and garlic, and obviously its name comes from the city of Krakow. And so, let's see, the most popular kielbasa is called kielbasa polska, Polish sausage, or countryside sausage. This one comes closest to what is generally known in America as kielbasa. Nowadays, many major meat packers across America offer a product called kielbasa, usually somewhat different from the original. In Poland, kielbasa is often served with fried onions and a form of cut pieces of the onion. Smoked kielbasa can be served cold, hot, boiled, baked, or grilled. It can be cooked in soups with cabbage. And a variety of other dishes. It is certainly at the center of Polish culinary life. Do you have a favorite kielbasa, Kim?
It's just about I can get kielbasas that are imported now, and they don't have a. The ones made in this country have a little more preservatives and are different in flavor. They might not be as hot or as peppery. But just about any kielbasa you buy on off the rack, they're all good. They make a great sausage New Orleans, a kielbasa thing. But it's just like you said, it varies from region to region. And that's the same with any sausage in any country around the world. Each region like they have a different dialect of their language. They have different preparations for their food.
Right.
And you get prosciutto's made differently than it is in Western Spain, Iberica. Yeah.
Interesting. We're just talking a little bit of food history on Bastille Day today. We started talking about the influence of French food in the country and wound up concluding that it hasn't spread so much in America because the French are snobby people. And where the Italians, come on, they welcome you, they give you a big kiss and a hug, and they want to speak to you. And as a result, we love Italian food. That's right. And you'll roll into an Italian place.
And, you know, the immigrants from Italy were generally from the south, where there are more red sauces, Napoli started with the pie, pizza, in Naples, and more sauces and pastas, and so meatballs and things like that, you'll see. And in the north of Italy, there it's more abundant with produce and varieties of cheeses and things. But every bit as good in the south as the north, just different.
Right.
And that's just the way it rolls. And they're all great. And in France, they're catching on. French food is magnificent. It has a tendency, from my experience in this country, unless it's a little bistro, you know, like a small little family-owned restaurant, or like a trattoria is the same in Italy.
What does that mean?
And they're usually small family-owned restaurants, and they serve more reasonably priced foods. They're a little bit more amicable to Americans or anybody. And now, in today's France, if you like their food and eat their food, they like you. Now, but you have to be, if you don't know what it is, you got to try it. They're eating it at the next table. You're not going to die. So, and you might be surprised how much you like it and enjoy it. So, from my point of view, because I am kind of a foodie guy, I try any damn thing.
Right.
You know, hog's head, you know, roasted hog's head, and they sit it on the table. The snout, the ears, everything. And by the time you're done, there's just the skull. And I mean, that first time I did that, that was a real eye-opener for me.
You think?
But I was game.
Was there alcohol involved? Was there alcohol involved?
A little bit. Early, and then it got to be a lot. But it's delicious. It's roasted for a long time or cooked over a spit. And if you haven't seen a whole hog, and they do a lot of that in this country now since barbecue is so popular.
Right.
But they'll split a whole hog, they'll put it on a spit, and some people will smoke it and they cut it in half and they flip it, or they'll tie it up, they'll stuff the belly, you know, Kahlua pig in Hawaii. You gotta embrace it and just take a chance and walk on the wild side. Be careful, you might like it. But you walk into a French restaurant, and if it's white tablecloth French restaurant,
right?
You know, it's going to be more expensive for the most part, and and maybe a little bit more aloof.
Maybe. I mean, you know, but again, that if I were to stereotype a French restaurant, I would agree with you, right? I would certainly agree with you.
But now today, you walk into any restaurant in this country and they're going to welcome you. You know, pricing depends on any restaurant, whether it's a high-end Italian or a little trattoria that serves spaghetti and meatballs and pasta with different sauces, you know, like spaghetti and clam sauce. That's a peasant dish. I used to serve carbonara that was a peasant dish at Sanders. And, you know, you know, it's number one what you can afford, and number two, especially in French restaurants like we've been talking, they're much more amicable to us if it's an all-French restaurant, which you go to the French Laundry in Napa Valley, which is one of the top two or three restaurants in this country, and you come out of there with wine and a full meal, and you've probably spent about $200 to $300 a person. So, you know, it ranges from that to a little French bistro on a side street in San Francisco or New York City that serves killer food for very little money.
Yeah, you know? It is curious to me how we as a nation and again, American cuisine, like I said, it's a mutt. It's everything. It's everything from Asian food, from Indian food to it's everything. It's amazing. French culinary history so prominent, yet not so much. And when you think of that, if you ask most people to name what are the kinds of food you like, it's not in the top three. And so it's just kind of interesting. If you were to say by genre, what's your favorite kind of food? What would you say? What nation? Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I would have to say Italian.
Yeah.
Because number one, that was my first serious restaurant job in Europe when I went over there. Number two, I love the people. The women, well, you can say that's it,
but that doesn't have anything to do with your taste buds.
Well, it does with me.
No, it doesn't. I know you. Your mouth has serious game when it comes to, you know, what's up.
But I would have to say Italian food, and then I would say French food, and then I would say, the German food is very, very heavy for the most part. A lot of meat and potatoes and cabbages. I love cabbage rolls, but yeah, I'd have to say Italian and French are my two favorite. And
no way.
I like
you like you like Mexican food way more than you like French food.
No, I'd say I'd take French food. Mexican food would be my third favorite. In my wheelhouse, but I mean, you know, good Mexican food in Grand Forks, North Dakota, is pretty damn impossible to find. Now, where you live, you'd have to be blind not to be able to find a good Mexican restaurant.
If you take your hands off the wheel and just smash into something, chances are it'll be a Mexican restaurant.
Be a great Mexican restaurant for the most part.
Well, yeah, and
when you find people that run restaurants from their homeland, you're gonna be in the front row for the most part, because they are bringing their culture, their styles, techniques, and ingredients from Mexico, or France, or Italy, or Poland, or Germany, but Mexican food, because, you know, there are brothers and sisters south of us. It's tremendous food.
Yeah, it's killer.
Yeah, and as a day-to-day food, I would go with Mexican food first. If I lived where you live,
and could get it,
and I could get the real deal.
Yeah.
And there's Greg Lotus turned me on to this food cart that's open Thursday, Friday, and Saturday out near Home of Economy, and it pulls in and it serves one or two things for lunch, a soup, and then either enchiladas or tacos or burritos. But man, you know, it's made with tongue and tripe soup, menudo. We've had that discussion many times, but it's the real deal. And it's these two Mexican ladies that live in Crookston that hit it out of the park completely. So that's about as close as I can get. And there is a Mexican market in Crookston that serves the food, a little cafe in the back that I just discovered in the paper about a month ago that I haven't had a chance to go try. So that might be my only hope for the real deal. But you're blessed with where you live, that's for sure.
Interesting. Interesting. All right, sir. First of all, thank you very much. Happy Friday. Happy Bastille.
Happy Friday to you, Mac.
Happy Bastille Day.
Happy Bastille Day.
Will you be celebrating Bastille Day?
I will not, other than facing France and genuflecting. That's about the extent of it. I wish them well, and I hope they have a safe day today, not like last year.
Yeah, no kidding. All right, sir, I will talk to you. Thank you.
And thank you, Marines everywhere, and bon appetit, mon amis.
There you have it, from the All Marine Radiohead Show. All right, Kim, I will talk to you. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you very much, Matt.
You bet. We're going to take a quick break. We'll check some news headlines. General join us at the top of the hour. More of All Marine Radio coming up next. Tuesday edition, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.